Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:11, and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday, June 17th, and of course, it's being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And well, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then at the beginning of the week, we had pricing in of the increasing potential that the UK would leave the EU. But following the tragic events in Northern England yesterday, where a pro-Remain politician was in many respects executed by for her political beliefs, regardless of the motivations or mental disposition of the person who committed the crime, she was murdered for her beliefs, that is likely to have an effect on sentiment. And we have to also consider that betting odds never actually went towards the exit campaign. So the result is that the majority of stock markets have begun to rally as some of that angst about exactly what it would represent for the UK, for Europe and the global economy is beginning to be unwound. And that then, what we have seen over the last few weeks is that precious metals, bonds, the dollar and yen were all rallying and have pulled back a bit. And stock markets and a number of commodities have pulled back and have bounced. So the biggest bounce in here today was the Italian index. It was up 3.5%. When you look a bit, take a more widespread view, then the majority of indices were in positive territory, but most of them in the region of about 1%. Now, obviously, investors will not have any degree of true comfort until they know exactly what the result is likely to be, and that will be on the 24th. Now, when you look at some of those chart patterns, then there has been a deterioration, and it isn't just over the last couple of weeks, that Europe in particular, having pulled back with the US back in January, has so far failed to break the medium-term downtrend. And that downtrend has been in evidence now for in excess of a year. So what had happened was with the devaluation of the euro more than a year ago, stock markets took off. And the euro has been largely range-bound for more than a year now. And with that range, the ability of eurozone stocks in particular to be able to hold on to their gains has certainly been questioned, and a number have pulled back, and some violently so, and particularly since the beginning of this year. Now, there are a number of issues facing Europe, and the Brexit campaign has certainly helped to increase at least the discussion of what those issues are. And unfortunately, it's regardless of which way the vote actually goes, it's unlikely to create a short-term resolution for what the challenges that Europe has are. But its dearth of democratic responsibility, particularly from the European Commission, and the rather toothless way that the European Parliament has been set up, really does mean that it is not a democratic institution. And when things were all fine and dandy, and the Eurozone economy and the European economy generally was expanding, then none of these real things became problematic. But with contraction, with anemic economic growth and high unemployment, then and the additional fact that we've had a massive intervention and dislocation in the bond markets as a result of quantitative easing, and no longer just in the US but in Japan and Europe, and increasingly extraordinary measures implemented to try and achieve what they say is their ambition of fomenting inflation, and massive disquiet. Now, unfortunately, and I don't like talking about politics in an investment service, but the reality is that politics are impinging on the investment world, and we can draw a very clear line between the fact that there are two primary effects of quantitative easing. The first is that we get asset price inflation. So when central banks start printing money, then you get inflation in asset prices. And that's certainly the case in stocks, certainly the case in bonds, and most particularly in bonds, but also in property. Now, that's there is a really clear cause and effect relationship there. The additional issue that it creates, and it is also a cause and effect relationship, is that yields go down, and therefore savers are robbed of their income, and speculators benefit, because when you get these kind of momentum moves where yields go to zero, and at the present moment below zero, then the only people that really benefit are the momentum traders. The investor who is holding on, then it is all about when did they buy. And the people that were buying bonds a year ago or 2 years ago are probably sitting on very comfortable profits at the present moment. But what about the people that are having to roll their debt forward? Then they're rolling into negative yields, and on a yield to maturity basis, there's absolutely no way that it just technically that they could possibly make money on that investment. So then you were in a trader's environment, but by rewarding speculators, then you're robbing savers, and that is contributing to this political disquiet. And the problem is that when you get this polarization and you get a push towards increasingly extreme political views, then that represents a risk premium for markets, because we just don't know who is likely to get to power and what is likely to be their particular take on events. So then when we look around, the likelihood is that this is going to continue, because there's no evidence at all that central banks have any real intention of changing. But we are at a point where the 10-year bond this week in the 10-year treasury in the US got down to 1.5%. And that's a psychological level, but it's also in the region of where the low in yields was back in 2012. And the 30-year treasury went to a new low in the yield last year and subsequently rallied. And the 10-year has got base formation characteristics. Now, with an easing of some of the stress in here today, then we've had a rally, or at least a bounce, in stock markets outside of the US, and bond prices have pulled back a bit, so then US Treasury yields have gone up. Now, there are over $10 trillion of sovereign bonds with a negative yield at present, and they're particularly in Europe and in Japan, the countries that still have highly rated bonds within the G7 are the UK, the USA, and Australia. And everywhere else has got negative yields. So we are at an extraordinary juncture in terms of the bond markets. And this isn't a condition that can last inevitably. So that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to stop in the short term either. But it does mean that it is going to create a problem in future. Now, when we think about crowd psychology and contradiction, then and you take a big long-term view, then one of the key characteristics of crowds is that they are tolerant of contradiction. And we have ample evidence of that within the markets, because when Japan was booming in the late 1980s, people really did believe that they knew better than anyone else how to manage a company. and didn't consider that anybody else could ever approach their way of doing things, which of course is ridiculous, because anybody can learn how to do anything if someone else can learn how to do it. So that turned out to be a fallacy. Tech stocks, where people really did say that earnings don't matter, and of course we know that earnings do matter. They matter an awful, a great deal. But for a while, people were willing to entertain the fantasy that earnings don't matter. Now, in the, before the credit crisis, people really thought that everybody could hedge their default risk, and of course, not everybody can hedge default risk. Somebody has to bear the default risk. Now, what we have right now is that you can continue to buy bonds with a negative yield and expect to make money. And then that might work for a while because it's a momentum trade. But it also means that when the market turns, that people will have to scramble to get out of those bonds because they will be in such a, they'll be then losing money both on a capital basis and a yield basis. Whereas right now, what has happened, at least until today when yields bounced, was that you might be getting a negative yield, but the capital appreciation was more than compensating you for that. But when you're in negative yields, then the yield isn't just declining, it's actually a headwind. And you pay for mistakes in that kind of environment when you've had such an incredible momentum move. Then if we look at what is it exactly that central banks are likely to do, well then Europe, they are continuing to extend the range of assets that they're willing to accept for collateral. So then it's been my belief for quite some time that the ECB today is probably where the Fed was about 3 or 4 years ago. And that's probably the same way with European stock markets. Because in 2011, Wall Street had a big pullback because people didn't really believe that they were willing to continue with quantitative easing for the amount of time that was required. And you had a very volatile trading, but that gave way to one of the most consistent uptrends in quite some time, because people got the message that the central bank was going to print money until it got the result that it wanted. And there is no evidence to believe that that's not exactly what the ECB is going to do. And the only thing that's holding it back is that you have one currency and you have 28 different fiscal policies. And that is a major headwind, and not least because the politics within each one of those states is very, very different. So the ability for concerted fiscal policy right across the Eurozone is virtually nil. When you have these votes from member states, and regardless of which way the UK decides to vote, then it's entirely open to question whether it's going to be the last country to vote. Denmark is also a very Eurosceptic country, and they might yet vote to leave. So these are very important questions. There are very important questions to answer for Europe, because if European equities are going to rally in much the same way that Wall Street did between 2012 and 2015, then some of these questions need to be answered. And without it, we're going to be have the risk of having a much more volatile environment. And that really does mean then that it's going to be the kinds of companies that benefit from a reasonably weak currency and a strong export market are going to be the ones that outperform. And Adidas is a great example of that in Germany, where it's been benefiting from growth in China for its products and doubly from the relative weakness of the euro. Whereas, for example, BASF, which made an acquisition from Albemarle in here today has been trending lower for over a year and really needs to do more to break that medium-term downtrend. So, but of course, it has a primarily Eurozone-based business. It has obviously global ambitions and certainly has a sizable international franchise, but the majority of that money does come from the Eurozone. So it is, and I think that's a very good example of what we can expect. Now, if for any reason that we could conclude that governance is improving in the Eurozone, that you get a group of politicians together with vision and gumption that can put together a framework for greater democracy, greater accountability, then you would have the makings of what could be a very impressive bull market, because it would improve confidence and potentially help economic growth as well. But right now, there isn't much evidence of it. And as we move into the political election cycles for a number of large Eurozone countries, then there's very little likelihood that that's going to happen this year or indeed next. When we look at Wall Street, then Wall Street finished down on the day today, having been up yesterday. And it still remains in a sort of a corrective environment overall. But so far, the decline has been reasonably modest. And the Nasdaq has got another lower high. The S&P 500 is in the region of its 200-day moving average. And if the size of the reaction is only going to be down to the 200-day moving average, then it would be very shallow indeed. And we do have to consider that the market has already been ranging for a year and a half. So this is a very well-defined range. And then it is a very big question. Is it a consolidation before the market goes higher, or is it a medium-term peak and a potentially developing type 3 top? We've had two massive reactions against the prevailing trend already, so it is a type 2 hybrid, if indeed it is a type 2 top. So a breakdown from that trading range would constitute a medium-term peak, if that is indeed what happens. And the role of central banks here also is a very big component. And I think it's reasonable to argue that the USA needs a fiscal bump as well, that there has to be some major infrastructure building going on to help to reinvigorate the economic expansion. So wages are beginning to rise, but corporate profits are not rising. So then this is a potential issue, and it's something that's weighed on the market, and it's part of the reason that it has been going sideways for so long. Now, then you have to think about the negative interest rate policy that you have in Europe is inherently deflationary. And the fact that it is inherently deflationary against a background where the ECB's only mandate is to target inflation, then they're going to engage in additional quantitative easing. And eventually, they're going to have to think about what exactly it is they're doing with having these negative interest rates. They could have embarked on quantitative easing without going negative. And if they do, in fact, decide that negative interest rates are not the kind of policy that is going to give them the objectives that they have, well, then their alternative is outright inflationary policies. Because right now what they're doing is they're hedging their inflationary policies, and that's part of the reason that the market is going down. If the Fed is unable to raise interest rates any further, and they are going to leave the size of their balance sheet unchanged, then we're not going to see additional new money coming into the market. How likely is it that the liquidity situation is going to tighten up further in the short term? So we might be in this range for a while longer. If, on the other hand, the Fed decides that They're not going to raise rates, but they're going to cut rates again to retard the advance of the dollar when the ECB is moves into outright inflation targeting, then that would act as another bullish catalyst. And you know, one of the ways that we've characterized central banks is that they are serial bubble blowers. And valuations are in equities, particularly Wall Street, they're pretty fully valued. So then if markets were to break on the upside, and it would be almost certainly in response to a change in monetary policy rather than any other factor, at least that's what we could say from the current perspective, then we'd be moving into the third psychological stage of a bull market, which would be acceleration, that they would have succeeded in blowing another bubble. And that might be in response to fiscal or deficit spending, which would also act as something that would depress yields, because it would respond to an additional stimulus measure. But of course, if we do move into the third psychological perception stage, we also know how they end. So a bubble might persist for a year, it might even persist for 2 years, but then we get a crash, and it could be a particularly big one, considering just how much debt there is out there. So then we would have to prepare ourselves for that. But perhaps the best possible scenario would be for additional ranging, and potentially volatile ranging, which would allow corporate valuations to contract in much the same way that they did when they ranged between 2000 and 2013. I don't anticipate that we're going to have a range of that length, but a range of another year, which would allow valuations to get more reasonable, and which could really then help to act as a foundation for additional upside in the stock market, would be the best possible scenario. But of course, we don't always get the best possible scenario. So, and this is a point of indecision, and of course, that is why, you know, that is also characteristic of a ranging environment overall. So, because the arguments come back into equilibrium, and it's reasonably easy to make both the bullish case and the bearish case based upon the available facts when you've got this rangy environment overall. But even in a bearish case, and this would be if you wanted to make the bearish case for Wall Street, it would be that the economic growth is not coming through. I'm just going to cough just one sec. Excuse me. Well, then we have had a massive breakout from a very lengthy range, and this is the first big consolidation from that. So we could still be in the very early stages of a secular bull market on Wall Street. And it remains the case that we just have to get over the hump of normalizing interest rates. And I think, rather than any other question, the big question is, are we going to have a bubble first before we get over the hump of interest rates, and then a big bear market, which is followed by a secular bull market? Or are we going to go through an additional ranging phase, which allows valuations to improve, and then we have a major bull market? So then what's the third one? That we could just come down and go sideways for a very long time. But I don't think that you have the extremes right now to generate a massive bear market, similar to what we saw in 2008 or in 2000. And then that would suggest that significant pullbacks will remain buying opportunities for the types of companies that either are emblematic of a big theme or are those that benefit from big themes. And a number of big themes are certainly developing out there, and technology and the innovation in technology, which is inherently deflationary, is going to not only change the way we live our lives, but it's also likely to greatly enhance the profitability of companies because their productivity is going to improve. It's also likely to have a significant impact in labor relations, and not least because of unions and because of people looking for a living wage, and perhaps even just looking for employment, but also in the nature of the kind of jobs that we will end up doing. So, these are incredibly large questions, but they're generally going to be really very positive for the corporate sector. And that is the kind of thing that could drive a significant bull market. Then when you look at that technological innovation, then it is in big data, in automation, robotics, and healthcare, that you have the greatest evidence that these types of innovations could really change the world. Then when you look at the availability of that technology, the rise of the global middle class, and the increasingly global fungibility of technology, meaning that when somebody invents something in any one country, that they can instantly market that product to the world. And when I talked to these guys at this startup, really, in Georgia earlier this year, Software, that was a point that came through very clearly, that they've only just released their product onto the market, and they've already had a slew of meetings with billion-dollar companies in Asia that want to buy their product because they anticipate automating their entire workforce within the decade. It was interesting. I think it was either last week or the week before that Foxconn has fired nearly 50,000 people in the last year and replaced them with robots. And that's a company that has got a workforce of 1 million people, and they probably want to reduce that workforce by 90% within the decade and replace them with robots. So, and then that is going to greatly enhance that company's profitability. So, it's also going to create, significant issues for the kinds of countries that do not embrace improving standards of governance, because you need improving standards of governance to boost education, to boost the availability of jobs, to enhance the services sector, and without it, then you get sclerotic. And that means that technology doesn't stop innovating, but societies do, and then they fall behind. So you need improving standards of governance. And that's part of the reason that what's happening in Europe, and there are existential questions that are being asked, are so important, because Europe is at the threshold, and just like the rest of the world, of a massive pace of technological innovation. And if the continent and the economy is going to thrive in that environment, then technological innovation has to be embraced, and accountability and democracy are big parts of that. So these are really very big questions indeed. And when we look around the world, then the rise of the global middle class, technological innovation, and low energy prices are really very profound. And when I was at this talk with where Jeff Gundlach was talking, and he was recounting how he had been sitting down with the chief strategist of the largest sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East, and they are planning for $10 oil. Then they're not necessarily going to get $10 oil, but they're planning for it because they're anticipating that electric cars are just one technological cycle away from game-changing range enhancements. And if you can get rid of range anxiety, then electric vehicles become very, very compelling indeed. And they estimate that that would remove 4 million barrels of demand a day for oil in the USA. Now, considering that shale oil and gas represented an increase of 1 million barrels a day, then a removal of demand for 4 million barrels would have a profound effect on the energy sector. And it isn't really a question of if it's going to happen, but rather when. Because economies of scale are such that the factories that are being built and the demand for the product that there is such that these things will happen, and it is really only a question of how long it's going to take. So therefore, when you look at oil prices and that they have almost doubled since January, then this is not the time to be getting progressively more bullish. It's still a consistent advance, and it's bounced exactly where it needed to for it to remain a consistent advance. But that doesn't mean it's going to stay a consistent advance. Then we just have to watch it. We have to be very careful as to just how high it goes, because the higher it goes, the greater the incentive is for producers to increase their supply. And when that supply increases, then prices will come back down. And particularly in this type of chart pattern where you get an acceleration on the downside and you get a very powerful short covering rally, then more often than not, they are followed by a period of a pullback and right-hand extension. And we're still in the rally phase, and the strong likelihood is that it's going to be followed by a sharp pullback and then some prolonged ranging, because we already know what has happened with natural gas, where prices went up a lot, then they came down an awful lot, and now they've been ranging for the last 5 years between about 150 and mostly 450, although there have been occasional spikes up to $6. Now, if that represents a template, and I personally believe that it does represent a template for oil prices, then the lower side of that range is probably somewhere around between the sort of the $30 area and probably around 60, or maybe even 80. Probably more likely 60 and occasionally 80. And then that represents a very large range. And that could be prolonged for a significant amount of time, because we have exponential growth in the number of electric vehicles on the road. But in absolute terms, they're still very low. So we haven't reached a point of critical mass yet. But then there is an inevitability to all of this. And they don't just rely on government subsidies. So, and they are getting progressively cheaper, and their range is improving. And if that's the case, then we can anticipate that not only are we going to have lower energy prices, but we're going to have more energy. And if we have more energy and it's cheap, and we have productivity enhancing technology, and that's available to an increasing proportion of the global economy, then we have the foundations for a bull market. And that does remain the base case. But, excuse me, I'm going to cough again. Sorry about that. Then I think, the big question is, what do we do with all the debt? And that is going to remain the case. And we're still in this extraordinary monetary policy environment. And there's nothing really happened to question that we're not going to remain in an extraordinary monetary policy environment. So we are going to be treated to additional volatility. But there are very powerful bullish factors boosting productivity. It suggests that significant pullbacks will remain buying opportunities. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.